Okay, I've got a friend coming in from out of town this afternoon. Wonder what we should do. I know. Okay, Google. What are the places of interest in Kansas City?
Attractions in Kansas City include Country Club Plaza, Crown Center, and others.
Google's been identifying points of interest for a while, and, recently Google Maps started showing areas of interest in an orange color on the map. It's determined by some kind of algorithm. Of course, what is of interest depends on who you are, and Google can't know everything about everybody. But why are the Plaza and Crown Center areas of interest instead of 18th and Vine? Or the ruins of Kindaro and KCK, an important part of the Underground Railroad? Some would say that the assumptions underlying the advice reflect a bias, and that affects our choices about where to go and what to do. But then, whose bias is it? I'm Brian Ellison. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're exploring the ways technology, not just Google, reflects bias, or maybe reinforces biases we already have. Jess Rizak is Director of Digital Engagement at the American Jazz Museum. Good morning, Jess.
Good morning.
So did you notice those areas of interest on Google Maps, too?
I did, yeah. It was really interesting to look at and kind of see how it's reflecting what I think a lot of people know about Kansas City back to us, that a lot of the high traffic and areas that are popular and Googled and that a lot of the population of Kansas City go to, at least with a digital footprint, are west of Troost Avenue.
So is the Jazz Museum one of the areas of interest?
Yeah. The Jazz Museum, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and the Gym Theater in our neighborhood at 18th and Vine are all listed as areas of interest. But what kind of happens on that map is when there's a lot of areas of interest that are concentrated in one area and you zoom out, then those neighborhoods are highlighted orange. And so with those three cultural anchors, that doesn't give us the concentration that if you're looking at a view where you can see, say, downtown and the plaza at the same time, you're not going to see 18th and Vine highlighted in orange.
What else did you notice that's highlighted? You mentioned the plaza.
The plaza, Crossroads, a lot of districts. What was kind of most interesting to me when I zoomed in is that a lot of the individual places are big box stores that probably no one in Kansas City is going to tell you, oh, you absolutely can't miss this
Target.
Home and garden store, mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're in town. So it was interesting to see how that gets reflected back when 18th and Vine is a really unique cultural asset in the city.
How long have you been working at the American Jazz Museum?
I've been there for about 4 years now.
And what do you do as Director of Digital Engagement?
Well, it's actually a new position. I started out in a different area at the museum and about 6 months ago moved into this position. So it's really new for us. We'll be launching a new website soon. We're starting to kind of ramp up what we do on social media so that it's not just sharing marketing messages about what it is that we're up to, but that we're really becoming a hub for where you can learn about jazz or be a jazz fan, and we'll kind of curate that for you.
And you're taking care of sort of the digital and tech aspects of that.
Yeah, and also making a lot of digital improvements and upgrades with what the staff is working with at the museum too.
So I'm curious, in your work in the tech field, and we're going to be talking with others who work in tech as well today, but do you see evidence of bias in your work?
I do. I think the most surprising thing that I found that I really didn't expect to find when I started at the Jazz Museum, I was a new resident to Kansas City. So I was using Google Maps a lot. And there were a couple times where I would be in a different part of the city and navigating my way back to work. And the route that it would give me, I just felt was not right because I know that the Paseo is there. I know that that's a fast street to take, or Troost can be a quick route back to work. And there were some times where it would take me, you know, south of the city or way west of where I actually work in order to get back in what it thought was the quickest route. So you really see that kind of bias where people are affecting the way that that app thinks that is really the best way to go.
And do you have a sense of why that's happening? Do you know enough about how Google Maps works to have an explanation for that?
Yeah, I mean, it's designed on an algorithm, and I think that people try to take as much bias as they can out of the math and the science and social science that is used to create that. But you have on the one side where most of the people who are working in technology and on those algorithms, they aren't in Kansas City necessarily. They don't know the uniquenesses of the city. A lot of them are white. Most of them are men. And so I think that it's designed in a way that it's just reflecting back kind of 19th century history of Kansas City in a 21st century way.
Let me bring Lewis Bird into this conversation. He's president of Melly Blue, which calls itself Cross-Cultural Brand Consultancy for Engineering and Technology Firms. Hello, Lewis.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. What does that mean, Cross-Cultural Brand Consultancy?
Well, basically, cross-cultural, in its most basic sense, is being able to communicate with people across boundaries. I mean, it's right there in the name. Mm-hmm. So with that, you have people that have different cultural backgrounds, different parts of the world. Ethnicity, of course, is in there. But it also applies towards overall diversity as well.
And how did you get into that kind of work?
I actually got into it. I stumbled into it, actually. When I first started my company, I was focusing on just overall multimedia work. And I was working with a lot of the bigger ad agencies and creative agencies in town, and they would see my company website or they'll see the work, and they would assume that because a lot of the characters on the website are a lot of the stories that were being seen was predominantly Black people, they was like, oh, you do great urban work. And at first I honestly hated that because, I mean, just to be honest with you, urban, it translates to Black.
It's a euphemism.
Exactly. Yeah. So for a while, I hated that. But then I decided to take ownership of it if everyone's going to keep putting me into that space.
And so what kind of work then do you do for these companies now? Are you helping them reach a primarily African-American audience? Is that the idea?
No. Actually, we're focusing more so on people. Cultural competence is a huge part of our business. And what that is the ability or the aptitude of an organization to basically change how they communicate and engage with people from diverse backgrounds.
Okay, so as an African American working in technology and trying to translate between different fields and different companies, how well represented do you feel like people of color are in the tech world?
I mean, all you got to do, Brian, is look at the numbers. I mean, the number is 2% as far as Black people. Hispanic population, which doesn't always include all the Latinx people, but that comes down to what, 4%. Women are on average 20% at most.
And what's the cause of those low numbers, in your view?
I mean, the cause is, again, kind of going back to there's a stigma. There's an overall stigma, as Jess mentioned, predominantly white males. With that, you have bias. And just to be clear, we all have bias, first and foremost. But, you know, that plays a huge part into it, and then the cultural competence aspect of it.
And is it a problem of recruitment, of education at an early age, or is it a problem of you have perfectly well-qualified people of color who are just, for whatever reason, not getting into that field?
I think it's actually a culmination of all of it. But with that being said, for example, there's approximately 5,000 graduates of Black people with a computer science degree every year. Yet we only still have 2% in many tech companies. So I think that a lot of companies use the pipeline as a scapegoat, mm-hmm. but that's really not the reality.
Okay, so with that in mind then, what do you think is the consequence of that, of not having more people of color writing the code, building the apps, developing the algorithms?
It goes back to what we're talking about here, like with the Google Maps. Now, granted, you know, Google is in the Bay Area. They're not. Well, I guess they are here, right?
but they're everywhere.
Right, they're everywhere. So the computer scientists and the developers, they're not necessarily concentrated here. That plays into it. But overall, I believe that the consequence is not having that culturally. From an ethnicity standpoint, culturally diverse perspective, even if gender is at play, women bring a special diversity to the table as well. So,
but I mean, and we keep using this word algorithm. By the way, you're a tech guy. Tell us what an algorithm is.
The most basic way to put an algorithm is a sequence of operations for a software to do his thing.
Okay. So if you've got this sequence of operations, that doesn't sound like there's much room there for discrimination, for bias. If this is just the computer sort of plugging through the numbers and spitting out a result, how does that show bias or discrimination?
I will say, although this is why I love math.
Yeah.
Although math is universal, at the end of the day, it's still man that creates it or that puts together those functions.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the hardware or the technology, the algorithm itself is unbiased, but the people that actually develop it, they have bias. That's why it's important to understand your own personal bias and how it impacts the decisions that you make.
Lewis mentioned not only race as one area where there's bias, but also gender. I want to ask you, Jess, as a woman who's attuned to how this technology works, do you see ways that sexism is baked into the system?
Yeah, I definitely do. I started building websites on my own when I was about 14 years old. I just developed an interest in journaling, wanted to be able to do some customization, and then just kind of got taken away with how much fun I could have with it and the things that I could do. And so throughout high school and college, working in those workplaces or those teams that are working to do that kind of web design work, I really found that a lot of times it's all men or all boys when I was in high school, that a lot of times I felt like I was just they were excited to have a girl in the room. And there was a lot of times where I felt like I wasn't and never really could be part of that group. And I think that some of that feeling in high school especially is what kind of led me not to pursue computer science or web design or development as a degree.
I'm struck also by, you know, we're talking about it from the standpoint of you as developers or as tech people, but also from the standpoint of users. So if I'm on Facebook and I search for something in particular, I buy a particular product, I notice that it starts to change the things that I see in my feed or the ads that pop up along the side. I imagine that that also can sort of reinforce racial or gender stereotypes or biases or preferences. Am I right?
Yeah, certainly. It can definitely have a impact on all those things.
Yeah, I had an experience as I was graduating college. I got engaged. And as soon as Facebook knew that I was engaged, my Facebook experience just wholly changed, totally up on its head with just constant ads for wedding planning and flowers and who knows what else. But all of these things that were just communicating to me that all I was a bride. Mm. I was also about to graduate college. I was about to become a graduate student. You know, there were a lot of other big life moments that I would tell you were more important than planning a party. But that was what Facebook really kind of boiled me down to.
Now, if Facebook were sitting here, and in fact, we invited Google to be sitting here, by the way, and they declined to participate in today's program. But if they were sitting here, I have to think they would say, we're only trying to help. We're trying to identify what your things of interest are. Maybe Google would say, hey, these are the places where people go in Kansas City. These are where the numbers are. What's wrong with them simply reflecting back what they know?
Well, like with Google, in their description of this new maps program and this new highlighting of areas of interest, they say that they can't do it in New York City. They have humans that sit there because they can't do the math right to make New York City look correct on Google Maps. So I think that they have acknowledged that there are problems with bias in the code or problems with the code, and that our tech companies just have to take seriously the way that they're reflecting back and in some ways re-entrenching systemic racism or sexism or whatever it may be on their platforms. You know, they have to see that people in Kansas City may feel like the neighborhoods east of Troost aren't safe neighborhoods. And then when they highlight the map as great places to go west of Troost, that reinforces a lot of opinions.
Well, hold on real quick. I'd like to
ahead,
add
please.
To that.
Yeah,
I agree with that. But I also would like to say that I don't think we should put all the onus necessarily on the tech companies. And the reason I say it is because as a city, Kansas City, we have to take ownership of that. If you think about the past decade and a half where all our investments have been at, they all have been in that 1.5 to 2 mile radius. And that 2 mile radius, you know, River Market, downtown Power and Light, Crossroads, Union Station, that's where all our investments is going. And if we think about, you know, going back to the Jazz District, you know, it hasn't evolved since it opened up in 1992. We haven't seen much change. So I think we also have to take onus as a city about that.
I want to invite our listeners to join that conversation. And including that point, do you feel like the city bears some responsibility? Do you feel like you've seen evidence of bias in technology, in an app or in a website or your mobile device? Give us a call and tell us about it at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. Let me ask you one more question before we take a break. What can be done about this, in your view? Are there steps that either a company like Google or even we as citizens can and should take right now to address this?
Yeah, I Lewis is absolutely right that it's also reflecting human behavior and city development. And I think that that's what's so positive about this new redevelopment initiative at 18th and Vine. I think that will give the stakeholders there in that neighborhood and the American Jazz Museum the tools to really build a flourishing district that no math could argue with is a great place to be in Kansas City. So we're really excited to see the city taking that initiative and excited to see that unique historic 18th and Vine flavor grow into something.
Lewis, what do you think?
I think, I'm not trying to be biased because this is what my business does, but I really do think that it also comes down to cultural competence. And that actually, it goes beyond just an organization or a business like Google or anywhere. I think that if more people understood and had more empathy and a willingness to take upon that empathy, it will really help in a lot of things, especially on a civic level.
Well, let's take a break. In a moment, we will continue this conversation about tech and bias. I want to thank Lewis Bird and Jess Rizak for being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with others engaged in this work of tech and in promoting areas of interest in Kansas City. I'm Brian Ellison. Stick around for more of KCUR's Central Standard in just a minute. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about technology and how bias, consciously or unconsciously, finds its way into our apps, our online searches, our tech devices. Joining the conversation now is Chepto Kositana-Buckner. She is Museum Director of the American Jazz Museum. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Michael Schantz. He's a research scientist at the International Computer Science Institute in Berkeley, California. He joins us from the studios of the Berkeley School of Journalism. Welcome to you, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're really glad to have you. Michael, let me ask you first, what got you interested in the intersection of tech and bias?
Well, I've always been interested in understanding how we can make a fair society and how the internet interacts with that. So I've been interested in measuring and preventing the censorship of the internet, in privacy issues, and this naturally led to me wanting to understand how companies might be discriminating based upon your online footprint.
And is that what you found, that companies do in fact discriminate?
We do have some interesting findings. So we ran experiments on Google to try and understand what information they're using to select the ads they show to people. In one of our experiments, we created simulated men and women, and then we had each group simulate having an interest in finding a new job. We then measured the ads shown to the two groups. And what we found is that the simulated males got many more instances of an ad promoting a career coaching service to get people executive-level jobs. Now, given what we already know about the gender pay gap, this is pretty concerning. It's really not the men who need encouragement to seek these jobs.
So what causes that? Is someone actually sitting down and typing in commands that will cause more men to see ads for high-paying jobs?
We really can't tell from the outside. This is one of the reasons why I think it's important for us to get a bit more transparency into what large companies like Google is doing. However, I think it's very unlikely that anyone at Google purposely desired this to happen. What seems more likely is that either their data set had biases in it, because these data sets are very large and they replicate pre-existing biases in society, or what's possible is that there were correlations that caused it. For example, the company, this career coaching service, they said that they were targeting individuals who already were earning a lot of money. We already know that that's correlated with males. Another possibility that Google raised is that there are more marketing targeting women than men, for example, household products. So maybe what actually happened is the men were just getting these ads because they were sort of the leftovers.
And the other ads that target women were crowding out this ad.
Exactly.
That's interesting. I have lots of questions about this, Michael, but I want to get to bring in Chepto here with us in the studio. Chepto, we spoke to one of your colleagues at the Jazz Museum in our first segment, but your expertise on this actually predates the work you're doing at the Jazz Museum, right?
Yes, it does.
Tell us about your background in technology.
My background in technology actually started in IT in the 80s, way before a lot of even women were in IT, but also was an IT director for the library for a long time. And before I joined the museum as deputy director of the library, I was leading a major initiative related to digital inclusion and making sure that access to the internet and technology was available for most of our citizens.
So you've invested all this this time and professional experience in technology helping us get the answers to our questions. Do you think technology can be relied upon for that?
Yes and no. In some circumstances, yes. Jess and talked earlier about some of the biases, and you can see that. But there are also a lot of positive things in that technology can do. If you consider some of the issues that have been going on with African Americans and the police, without the technology, some of that information would not have come to light, and the whole entire social media conversations about Black Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter, that is really because technology is bringing those issues to the forefront. I originally come from Africa, and one of the things that Africa has done beautifully in a lot of ways when it comes to technology is mobile money. There's this solution called M-Pesa that is used heavily in Kenya, and is in fact, actually, I was excited. The Smithsonian is displaying the whole entire M-Pesa as a major solution, which allows people of all socioeconomic level in Kenya to have a mobile telephone and to use that telephone or that mobile device to transact every kind of business, including paying bills and that kind of thing. And that is another way that I see where technology really has become an asset to the human people.
And Chepto, as in your own work now, either at the museum or before that at the library, did you encounter examples of where technology, sort of the other side of technology, showed itself, where there's bias that's sort of built into the system?
Well, yeah, the biases are there. I mean, if you look at, and Google, I think, I mean, again, it's not, this is the issues of whether it's the city, the community itself, as well as the technology companies. I agree with the speakers earlier that it's not just the technology company we should blame, but we should look at the rollout of Google when they came into town and the whole entire rally of getting people sign up. And when you looked at the places that were turning green, most of the places that were turning green were west of Troost and not east of Troost. And there are a number of factors related to that in terms of what happened. When I was working with my initiatives at the library, one of the statistics that is out there, and I don't know whether that gap has been breached, but 70% of the kids who attended the Kansas City School District did not have internet access at home. Mm-hmm. That to me is, and I always say it's criminal, because in this age where technology is a tool to access everything from health, education, and homework. If 70% of the students in our district don't have access at home, it means they're already left behind in a lot of ways. And so that's where I think it's very, very important that we all are fighting for equitable access, the training, the knowledge, and making sure that our city fathers and our civic leaders understand that we need to make sure that everybody is connected.
You know, I hear Chepto talking about Google Fiber. We've mentioned Google Search and Facebook. Michael Shantz, is it your sense that these large companies are concerned about this as a problem, or do they deny that this is a problem?
I think they are concerned. No one wants to show up in the newspaper looking bad, to say the least. But they also, I know a lot of people work at these companies, and they have genuine concerns about these issues. However, they're very difficult to solve. Currently, there's not many computational tools to help them find the biases in the data set and remove them. And what we do know how to do is much more expensive, involving humans looking over things. So I hope Google will look into these more expensive methods, but I understand that they can't get them to scale to the level needed to catch every instance of bias.
But, you know, it's interesting. You say you can eliminate bias by introducing humans into the process, but it seems like that would just introduce the potential for new biases or more bias.
That's true. It's biases all the way down, if you will. But the hope here is to have different perspectives so that the data can balance out. We know Silicon Valley is predominantly white and male. So if we had more voices there, they might test the algorithms in different ways and notice different problems with it than they're currently noticing.
So it comes back all the way to kind of the coding, programming level, the assumptions that go into building it in the first place.
Yes, but I don't want your listeners to picture someone typing at a computer, writing the actual computer program causing the problem. It's more in how they collect the data and how they test the code. The code itself is rather sterile most of the time. It's unlikely that the actual biases are there.
Well, let me ask you, Chepto, do you think that you as a woman and a person of color, do you think you're more sensitive to some of this than the men who might dominate something like app development?
Oh, I think I am. I mean, there are a number of things that I see, and I think that what we've got to talk about is not it's the gender issue, but I think it's also a socioeconomic issue. You know, you could have a number of African Americans or Latino or even white males that are writing this code, but if their social class is of a higher level and don't know how to live in a lower community and what the needs of that lower community is, it's really more of I think it's a class issue that we should also be talking about. In terms of the female issue, of course, I think women's needs are different. And I am a very, very independent woman. I'm not necessarily somebody that really likes to do housekeeping. So promoting housekeeping material to me is very offensive to me at this particular time. I'd rather get something else. I do like to shop, though. So, you know, for jewelry and clothes. But there are simple factors that you can see, for example, the way the mobile device is designed to go on a belt clip for a man. It's not designed for a woman to do that. The colors are not very fashionable in terms of that, you know, that coordinate with my clothing that I need. I mean, just some simple basics like that. I think the new iPhone has come up with, you know, different kind of colors, but just the basic simple design things on those particular pieces, I think are very, are not thinking about women's needs.
I invite our listeners again, 816-235-2888. If you have questions or comments about technology and the bias that you suspect or have experienced in apps, in devices that you use, 816-235-2888. Michael, you mentioned this research that you do surveyed a lot of data. How do you get that data?
So what we did was we interacted with Google using our own programs that simulated people. We couldn't get our experiments to scale using real people. Also, real people would bring various confounding factors. We wanted to compare completely identical simulated men and women so that we could isolate whether it was the gender that was influencing the ads.
So you weren't using real men and women. You were simulating men and women.
Yes, exactly. We were using computer programs to simulate them.
All right. Well, I suppose they're easier to get along with, but go on.
So then what we had is our simulated men and women. They went to Google, has this interface called Ad Settings, and you can go there and it gives you a window into the model Google has constructed about you. For example, Google thinks I'm a female. I don't know why, but it keeps getting that one wrong. And it has my age right, and it has various interests about me. But you can also change those. So what we did was we had our simulated men and women set their gender to be either male or female, and then that told Google what the gender was, and that allowed us to see how Google was going to use that information to show us different ads.
And does the data show that that's a really quick change? I mean, the moment you change your gender on Google, does it, or on Facebook, does it change everything?
Well, it doesn't change everything, but it does have a very quick effect on the ads you're going to see across the internet because Google puts ads not just on their own web pages, but on various web pages all across the internet through its ad network.
But let me ask you, Michael, and you, Chepto, something I asked our guests in the first segment, too. Isn't there value in this gaining of, certainly that's what I think Facebook and Google would say, that in gaining this information, in being able to target ads that they think there's a reasonable chance I would be interested in, they are actually helping me. Isn't that a value, Michael?
To an extent, it can be a value. However, we got to keep in mind that people aren't just stereotypes. So not all men and women want the same thing. So if Google just learns that and then treat us differently based upon it, it could be missing important things. The other thing to keep in mind is computers are pretty good at measuring what we do and not so good at measuring what we want. People often have short-term goals and long-term goals. What we do typically is biased towards our short-term goals and not our long-term goals. That's why a lot of people overeat and we tend not to save enough money for retirement. So the computers are really sort of amplifying the worst parts of ourselves, the impulsive parts of what we do today, and it doesn't consider what we want to do in the future at all.
And what do you think, Chepto? I mean, does it bother you that Google tries to meet your what it thinks your needs are?
No, I mean, I don't think it bothers me. It bothers me that it gets it wrong. Yeah. And so I think that the idea is how do you get it right? And I think I don't have a solution for this, but a suggestion that I would look at is that, you know, Google is harvesting all this data and content and creating a profile that they think meets your needs. But I think there has to be another element, which is the local factor. It's just like information. One of the things that I always say with the Google search engine, you can find tons and tons and tons of information, but then that tons and tons of information is not helpful because it's too much and you cannot kind of narrow it down to something that is useful. So the local angle becomes important, you know, partnering places like libraries or tourism industries within a city or a university that is doing urban planning and that kind of thing and understand a little bit better how the city is set up. So you don't leave it out in the Bay Area only, that, but connect with these major institutions within cities to make the data much more viable. I think we are a society that is very instantaneous right now. So being given information that, hey, you know, you like this, you might also like this, is very useful. It's just we've got to get it right. So so I'm not getting recommendations that I don't want to see.
Chepto, something you said earlier, you mentioned the ways that technology has, in fact, advanced the cause of justice in some other ways. You mentioned the way videos were able to spread virally on the internet and make people aware of brutality that was experienced by African-American communities, for example. But there's also been a number of stories just in the last few weeks about the ways that racial bias is given a pretty wide berth on social media. So thinking of during the Olympics, some of the Twitter attacks on Gabby Douglas or the overtly racist critiques of Colin Kaepernick in the last week or two. Do tech companies have any responsibility, do you think, to kind of make sure that user biases are not given free rein on their sites?
Well, I think hate speech is wrong, and that is important. But also we've got to be careful not to take away the greatest freedom that we have, which is the freedom of speech. And so that is a balancing act, I think, in a lot of ways. And I think there's a way to handle that. It's not just for the tech companies. I think it's suddenly a society issue. I always tell kids and I tell my children all the time, the way you behave outside the internet, you've got to behave the same way online because your digital footprint matters, just like it matters, your reputation matters, just like you're walking across the street. So yeah. I think it's a balancing act. We cannot take away freedom, but we cannot also use social media for hate speech.
Michael, before we let you go, I wonder if you have particular suggestions that you think companies should be implementing at this point to address this problem.
I think the first thing we need is more accountability. We need to give companies tools that they can use to audit their internal operations and find these problems before they get pushed out to the public. But there are always going to be disagreements over which areas should be considered areas of interest. Given that Google has such a dominant position in the marketplace, largely because it has more data than anyone else, it seems to me that a good thing for them to do would be to give us users more choice over how they present that data to us. And that way we can tell Google what we value and get Google to help us find what we value.
That's Michael Chance. He is a research scientist at the International Computer Science Institute in Berkeley, California. Also, we have Chepto Kosatani Buckner, who is director of the American Jazz Museum. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
When we come back from a break, we're talking about airline baggage fees. Nobody likes them, but as it turns out, they might just be making your flight experience better. At least that's what our guest says. I'm Brian Ellison. Find out more when Central Standard returns in just a moment.